Liegen over een mondkapjesdeal die je hebt gesloten met de overheid. Een deal waarmee je miljoenen hebt verdiend. Dat doet toch alleen Siewert van Liende? Nou, nee. Ik ben Felicia Alberding en in de Mondkapjesmiljonairs duik ik met een team van correspondenten in andere schandalen. Want wist je dat Siewert helemaal niet uniek is? Luister de Mondkapjesmiljonairs in je Podimo-app. Of ga naar podimo.nl/mondkapjes. En probeer Podimo 30 dagen. Podimo.nl/mondkapjes.
Hallo, elke week presenteer ik, Kees van der Bos, de Groene Amsterdammer podcast. Het is een gesprek met een journalist die die week een spraakmakend artikel publiceert in De Groene. Waarom dit verhaal? Was het moeilijk om het te maken? Wat waren de uitdagingen? Wat brengt het ons? En wie is die journalist eigenlijk? Elke week een goed gesprek in de podcast van De Groene Amsterdammer.
For me, what's very important is to write a book that has almost a novelistic feel to the place. I want my readers to smell Jena, to see how the streets looked like. What did they eat? How did it smell? But I don't want to invent anything. So all of this comes from letters where they describe how they sit together and they just come up with rhymes and poems and they agree to never agree. So these discussions are noisy and loud and they're fighting. So this is not like nodding to each other saying like, yes, you're right. Yes, you're right. It's about disagreement also. And it's not just their letters. Don't forget there are almost 900 students who write letters to their parents.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Janssen.
Hallo, welkom in Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 305 en welkom ook PG.
Dag Jaap.
PG, we gaan zo praten met Andrea Wolf, de auteur van het boek Rebelse Genieën. Zij was de afgelopen dagen in Nederland en jij zei meteen, ik wil haar in Betrouwbare Bronnen. Waarom?
Ik droom daar al jaren van, Jaap. En toen wist ik nog niet eens van dit boek. Dat maakt de droom alleen nog maar vuriger.
Want hoe ken jij Andrea Wolf?
Andrea Wolf is de schrijfster van het boek Alexander van Humboldt, The Adventure of Nature.
Alexander van Humboldt, waar jij het natuurlijk uitgebreid over hebt gehad. In één aflevering, maar zelfs meerdere afleveringen, wordt hij genoemd.
Natuurlijk, al in ons eerste seizoen, want toen begonnen we eigenlijk met natuurlijk de grote Alexander van Humboldt herdenking in de hele wereld. 250 jaar van Humboldt in 2019. Nou, jij weet nog dat Wopke Hoekstra naar Berlijn ging aan de Humboldt Universiteit om de Humboldt-lezing te houden, speciaal in dat herdenkingsjaar. En met ons ook toen nog heeft gepraat, ook over Alexander van Humboldt. En dat was dus nog maar het begin. Alexander van Humboldt, het grootste genie in wetenschap, ontdekkingsreizen en vooral ook het analyseren van de natuurwetten van misschien wel de Europese en zelf van de Duitse geschiedenis.
Ja. En Andrea Wolf is van Duitse komaf. Ze is geboren overigens in Delhi in India. Maar ze woont al meer dan 30 jaar in het Verenigd Koninkrijk. We zullen het gesprek straks ook in het Engels doen. En dat nieuwe boek wat ze heeft geschreven, Rebelse Genieën, dat is een heel interessant boek.
Ja, want we gaan met haar en de luisteraars op reis. We gaan naar een heel klein universiteitsstadje in Sachsen, het stadje Jena. Maar dat is maar 15 kilometer van het veel beroemdere, cultureel beroemdere Weimar. En in dat stadje Jena, daar was een soort concentratie van een jong talent. En als je het boek leest, Jaap, je zou ze zo vandaag in een studentencafé, in een politiek debat, in een bijeenkomst van studenten met hun hoogleraren en het onderzoek tegen kunnen komen.
Ja, het is een stadje waar je in 10 minuten doorheen loopt, met wat landerijen eromheen. Het had maar 4.500 inwoners en ongeveer 800 iets meer studenten.
Dus de universiteit was in dat kleine stadje eigenlijk wel de grote industrie.
De dominante factor.
Ja, en doordat het zo dicht bij Weimar was, kon dus de grote beroemde kunstenaars, dichters, wetenschappers van Weimar, zoals Johann Wolfgang von Goethe en Friedrich Schiller, die konden dus heel makkelijk naar Jena En kwamen daar ook vaak. Schiller is er zelfs gaan wonen. En die werd ja, een beetje de afgod van al die studenten en die jonge mensen. En die jonge mensen, dat is ja, heel bijzonder. Dat is een soort concentratie van uitzonderlijk artistiek, literair, wetenschappelijk, filosofisch talent geweest. Die elkaar ook helemaal gek maakten, in de goede zin van het woord. En ze zijn dus allemaal heel eigenzinnig, heel apart. Ze hadden dus ook permanent ruzie, in de goede zin van het woord. Ze daagden elkaar permanent uit. En het waren mannen en vrouwen. Want dat is ook heel bijzonder. Deze generatie jonge mensen maakte het niet uit. Of je man was of vrouw, ondanks dus die tijden van ancien regime waarin zij geboren waren en opgegroeid. Zij leefden in de meest revolutionaire fase natuurlijk van de Europese geschiedenis. Amerika was net een republiek geworden en onafhankelijk. Frankrijk giste, Duitsland giste. In heel Europa ging alles drie keer over de kop. En zij waren in die periode.
Ja,
en waren ze jong, waren ze gretig, waren ze verliefd, schreven ze, dachten ze, knokten.
En een van die vrouwen, Caroline Schlegel, die was ook een beetje het centrum van alles. Want in haar huis vonden de grote inspirerende gesprekken plaats. Daar kwam iedereen over de vloer.
Ja, en haar man, August Schlegel, had haar nou ja, zeg maar, uit de diepste ellende gered. Door haar persoonlijke en radicale leven en haar liefde voor de Franse revolutie. Ja. Dat verhaal dat zal Andrea Wolf wel vertellen. Maar ja, zijn jongere broer was ook helemaal verliefd op haar. En er was nog een nog jongere, toen al wereldberoemde jonge filosoof Schelling. Die was zo verliefd op haar, daar had ze een, ja, een relatie mee. Dus ze had ook nog een open huwelijk. Nou, dan had je ook nog de briljante jong gestorven dichter Novalis. Nou, je hoort het al, Jaap. En wie kwam er heel vaak langs om zich te laven en ze ook een beetje af te remmen? Dat was natuurlijk Goethe. Die was meerdere maanden per jaar, niet in Weimar, maar in Jena bij dat jonge volk. Dus het was een enorme concentratie van energie, ideeën en dus ook revolutie in het denken over de werkelijkheid.
Ja, en hoe die mensen daar samen zijn gekomen en wat die samenkomst betekende voor het denken, ook voor de wetenschap en zelfs voor de politiek, dat gaan we met Andrea Wolf zo bespreken.
Want Jaap, een aantal van de essentiële kerngedachten van die, zeg maar, die Jena-set zit natuurlijk ook in het werk van Alexander von Humboldt. Nou, het idee dat je snapt al die losse fenomenen, het weer, de oceaan, de bergen, de sterren, de planeten, dat is niet allemaal losse dingen. Dat is één organisch geheel. Denk aan dat grote werk aan het eind van het leven van Humboldt, 60 jaar later, Kosmos. Dus die idee van de organische eenheid van de schepping en daarmee dus ook dat de mens organisch onderdeel maakt als wezen van die schepping, dat is een erfenis tot de dag van vandaag in ons denken en ons blik ook op de toekomst van dat groepje jonge mensen uit Jena.
Ja, en je kunt zelfs stellen dat de politieke actualiteit van vandaag, ik noem het klimaatprobleem en wat de politiek daaraan doet, en ik noem ook de liberaal-democratische rechtsstaat, ja, die kun je voor een deel enten op wat daar al besproken werd.
En de opkomst van ongelofelijke heersers die de wereld op hun kop zetten. Want de tijdgenoot voor hen was dus niet alleen George Washington en Thomas Jefferson met die compleet nieuwe republiek, maar natuurlijk nog één, die korporaal van Corsica, Napoleon Bonaparte.
Die uiteindelijk ook zijn opwachting maakte met zijn troepen in dat plaatsje Jena.
En wat er toen gebeurde, Jaap, ik hoop dat Andrea ook daarover zal vertellen.
Maar eerst, PG, zijn er nog nieuwe vrienden van de show?
Jazeker, Jaap. Het zijn er weer een heleboel. Dus allereerst dank aan René, Christophe en Judith.
Ja, en als je ons steunt met een regelmatige donatie, één keer per jaar of één keer per maand, dan word je dus vriend van de show. Maar je kunt ons ook helpen met een losse donatie. En die waren er ook de afgelopen dagen.
Nou en of. En dus zijn we de volgende mensen bijzonder dankbaar. Dankjewel Christa, Jasper, Judith, Eva, Jozef, Leendert en Hild.
Wil je vriend van de show worden of ons steunen met een losse donatie? Ga dan naar vriendvandeshow.nl/bb.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Welkom in our podcast, Andrea Wolf. PG, would you like to start?
Yes, it's a delight to have you. And you come with a new book, a tome. And it is once more like your book on Alexander von Humboldt, about a generation of young Europeans who grew up and lived in wild times. An incredible time. Exciting, violent, radical, revolutionary in its change, in culture, in politics, social relations, in art, in literature, philosophy, in thinking. And your book is about, in particular, that element. The world went upside down. It was the start of the Industrial Revolution. It would make the 19th century, as Jürgen Osterhammel said, the transformation of the world. What makes these young people for you so fascinating that you couldn't stop writing about them?
Well, I think it's a group of rebellious thinkers and poets who really changed the way we think about us, the world, and nature. So I think history is not a pile of old ideas that have nothing to do with us. History gives us an insight to us, to our life today. So I'm interested in history because I want to understand why we are who we are. So for me, this group of thinkers and poets was a window into how we became who we are today. So for example, why are we so obsessed with ourselves? Why do we circle around ourselves all the time? You know, there's a whole generation called the me generation. So that is one aspect. In my previous book about Alexander von Humboldt, I looked at the relationship between humankind and nature in order to understand why we have destroyed so much of our planet today. So this book was almost taking a step from there. The first question is actually, why are we so obsessed with ourselves? But also, if we see the obsession with the self as something positive, when did we first ask, how can I be free? So all these questions, weirdly, like all the answers to these questions are in this tiny little town, Jena, in Germany, at the end of the 18th century. So as I was walking through Jena when I was doing the research on Humboldt, I suddenly saw all these name plaques on the houses.
Because these young people were all friends of both Wilhelm and Alexander von Humboldt, you discovered.
Yes, so it was literally through the research through Humboldt that I worked this out, which a lot of people might just know, but I didn't. I did a chapter about Humboldt's friendship with Goethe. For that, I went to Jena. I saw all these name plaques on the houses, and it is literally the who's who of German thinkers and poets. And I was just like, oh my God, everybody lived in this tiny little town. And then, you know, you dig a tiny little bit deeper and you realize they were all here at exactly the same time. But just, you know, a very short 10 years, basically, just a decade, everybody comes together. And I think there are these moments in history where you have a group of incredible thinkers coming together, and it almost magnifies the topics of that time.
Jena was a sort of Athens and Florence and maybe even Amsterdam.
At a different time, exactly. So you have these moments. You have the modernists like Hemingway, Fitzgerald in Paris in the early 20th century. You have the American...
Jena was a movable feast, like Paris.
Well, I don't know if it was a movable feast. It was very much just there, this little town.
But what's the reason? How did this place become the focal concentration point of this generation?
So there's something interesting happening in Germany at the end of the 18th century. So Germany is not a unified nation. So you have a jigsaw of 1,500 states, ranging from tiny little principalities to big, powerful states such as Prussia and Austria. The unintended advantage of this fragmentation is that censorship is relatively difficult to enforce. So Germans can do a bit more than say the English, who have a centrally ruled state, or the French.
And that's why in that time German literature flourished.
Yes, at this, and also, and I think that's quite important, Germany is not a big empire with colonies like the Dutch, like England, France, Spain. So in Germany, everything is inward looking. So the German imagination is fed by words and by books.
And
so
they had this one language, which stretched over those 1,500 principalities.
Exactly. So, but what you have is so literacy rates soar. Prussia and Saxony lead the world at the end of the 18th century. You have a book market that is four or five times bigger than the English book market, for example. So ideas and arguments circulate quite easily through the German states.
But why Jena?
Exactly. And then you have Jena. And Jena, I think there are two reasons. One is the ruler was quite an enlightened ruler. But the most important reason is the strange governance of the university, which through complicated inheritance laws has, by the time of the Jena Set, is ruled by four different Saxon dukes with no one really in charge. So people who have problems with the authorities in their states arrive in Jena because they can kind of teach there whatever they want. So you have Friedrich Schiller, for example, who is arrested in his home state, the Duchy of Württemberg, after writing The Robbers.
He was, of course, the great German playwright. Poet and playwright and historian on the Dutch revolt against Spain.
Exactly, exactly. And he arrives in Jena in 1789, and he acts like a magnet for the younger generation. They adore him and The Robbers, the kind of revolutionary play, the emotional play. And they, so one after another arrives in Jena, or he actively invites them. So he invites, for example, August Wilhelm Schlegel. Novalis studies in Jena because of Schiller. So he brings them together in this tiny little town.
So you're talking about a town of about, what is it? Four and a half thousand people. A university of how many students?
Just under 900. But so it's quite a lot of, the proportion is quite high in terms of, you know, people who live there and the students. So it's a town that is very much dominated by its students. So there's a library of 50,000 books. There are book printers, there are book binders, there are publishers there. There are lots and lots of taverns.
Professors.
Lots of professors. And I was absolutely blown away when I found this statistic that a quarter of all children born in Jena were born out of wedlock. So something was going on there, not just intellectually, but also in terms of open marriages, changing lovers. So it was a place of transience. People kind of came and left behind a trail of broken hearts
and books.
Children and books.
And as a professor, you had to create your own market. The students paid you directly.
Yeah, you got a very, very small salary. I mean, the University of Jena was famous for paying really literally nothing. And, you know, compared, for example, to the University of Göttingen, where you would earn good money. So the students, as they attended your lectures, would pay you for it. So the more students you had, the more money you would earn. So it was really worth being a popular professor.
Very market-driven,
yes.
Incredibly neoliberal, capitalist 18th-century institution.
I suppose it was, but I think it was more out of necessity because you were just not paid. So you.
But if you have four counts from all these small Saxon principalities who are your boss, not one of them, of course, is so interested that he's got to pay you.
Exactly. And no one, I mean, they actually don't care at all what's happening at the university. So that's the reason why professors could teach revolutionary ideas, visionary ideas. And it's also, take for example, Fichte, when he's super popular. More than half of the students of Jena come to his lectures. So he earns a decent amount because all the students are coming. So for the professors, it's in their interest to make their lectures interesting.
So the competition between the professors in an intellectual but also in a performance way must have been killing.
I think it was quite good for everybody involved. I mean, Schelling, for example, who's 23, he's the youngest professor at the university. He really knows how to stage himself. So he kind of would walk through his full auditorium to his lectern and then very slowly and deliberately light two candles. So the room would be left in the dark, but the students would see him kind of wreathed in light, you know, like the hero on the pedestal or something like that.
It's like Beethoven's hero in the Ninth Symphony. I was struck in the book, like with the Humboldts, there is no music in it. It's intellectual, it's philosophical, it's poetry, but there is no opera.
It's not. And it's interesting because it's the next generation of romantics, like E.T.A. Hoffmann, for example, who brings in music much more. He's a music critic, obviously, also. So, but this generation is, I mean, they're the young romantics, in German, the Frühromantiker. And I think today we associate with the romantics images of emotional music, images of lone figures and moonlit kind of forests.
Suicides.
But it's That first generation is very different, is very intellectual, is very radical. For them, romanticism is something much more complex and dynamic than, you know, candlelight dinners or something like
so
that.
So the definition of romanticism changed through the years.
Yes, and what they thought of romanticism is not what we think today. So for them, it is, they call it an organic being, so it's dynamic, and they... At the center of all is poetry, but not the way we understand it today, but in the ancient Greek definition, which means creative, productive.
So it's also science.
Yes, and it's about crossing, transcending boundaries. It's bringing
which, of course, is what Humboldt did.
Yes,
and with his travels, with his analysis, with his science.
So for them, it is just like two elements can create a new chemical compound. They believe that you can bring together different subjects and disciplines. So they bring together the arts and the sciences, but also humankind and nature. And for me, that is what makes them so fascinating and so different from what we associate with romanticism today.
Of course, looking at European and certainly German history, the French Revolution... You know, you say Schiller comes in Jena in 1789, the year of the Bastille and the revolution. But I have a question before that. Were they not inspired by that other great democratic revolution in the United States?
That's a very good question. And I've just come back from a one-month lecture tour in America, and everybody asked that there. I think... You have to remember when they are born. Most of them are born in the late 1760s, early 1770s. So they're too young to follow the American Revolution, but they are young men and women in their early 20s when the French Revolution happens. And so they actually see in front of their eyes what's happening. And that is so much more inspiring than something that happens across the Atlantic. So I think it has actually to do just with the timing of their birth.
That's why Goethe, who was, of course, older than they are, that he wrote America, du hast es besser. He was much more in tune.
He was actually of this entire group. I mean, he's the oldest in this group. He's a bit like the stern, benevolent godfather of this
group. And strangely, also one of the longest living persons in the
exactly.
group.
But he's also the only one who's really against the French Revolution. I mean, all the others embrace the French Revolution, at least at the beginning. And only then maybe have some, you know, some of them have problems then after Robespierre kind of, you know, chops off a few heads.
One of the fascinating things, the French Revolution started as this sort of constitutional innovation, liberté, égalité, fraternité. So they were completely enamored and struck. And then, of course, it went off rails. It became genocidal. How did they look at that? Did they say, okay, you know, you have to break some eggs to make some omelets, you know, like Lenin said and Jefferson said in America? Or were they more like John Adams in America and Goethe, who was abhorred that the evil element in human nature took over?
If we go one step back, so first of all, except of Goethe, they all embrace the French Revolution because the French Revolution does something which I think is almost impossible to imagine today. It proves, or when the French revolutionaries declare all men equal, they promise a new social order or the possibility of a new social order that is built on the power of ideas. So the French Revolution proves that ideas, your mind, is philosophy, is more mighty than kings and weapons. And
so, human rights, citizens' rights, so those ideas.
So philosophers suddenly realize they can change the world with their pen. Then, you know, thousands of heads roll off the guillotines and quite a lot of them become horrified by the excesses of the French Revolution. And Schiller, in particular, he writes about this because he believes that the French might have not been ready for equality and liberty. And he says the reason for that is the lack of morality. And he doesn't mean a morality like the fidelity of a spouse or your sexuality, because in that department, the Jena set is, you know, very quite open. It is more the morality of a society to be ready to govern itself. And Schiller and the others use art as the tool, art and beauty and aesthetics, as the tool to make people more morally mature. So what they are saying is that the Enlightenment, with its focus on reason, on empiricism, has brought us all this knowledge, but all this knowledge can't give the person the ability to judge what's good and what's bad. And so, they say art is the...
So that's where Romanticism came in.
Exactly.
But as Sheila said, well, maybe the French are not able to really imply all the consequences of the French Revolution. Did he also say that maybe the German people were much more able to have all the consequences?
What they said, none of the nations are quite ready yet. In order to be ready, you have to educate the people in terms of art, beauty, aesthetics. So you have to turn them into more morally mature people to then be able to deal with freedom and with equality.
This is such an interesting observation, because there are two people from that same period who also were interested in this and tried to do that. The first, of course, is Catherine the Great of Russia, whose huge legal innovations made Russia a constitutional, but it was called an ukaz. She wrote it herself, and she said, the Russian people is not ready for it. But I already installed this wonderful enlightened regime, but I remain, of course, a tsarina. And the other one, of course, is Tocqueville. Because this question of Schiller is, of course, what made Tocqueville go to America. To look, maybe Goethe is right, America, du hast es besser.
Well, the difference between Schiller and Catherine the Great is that if Schiller says it, he says it as a historian, as a poet, which is slightly different than being an absolute ruler, where it's very much in Catherine the Great's interest to say you are not quite ready for equality and freedom.
The French Revolution ended, of course, with Napoleon as consul and then emperor and then as ruler of all of Europe and then a sorry exile on St. Helena. Goethe called Napoleon Mein Kaiser. How did this younger generation look at Napoleon?
Well, Goethe was a realpolitiker. So he's actually of that group, the one who's in the beginning most critical of Napoleon, but then in the end decides this works actually better. Napoleon divides the Germans very much because on the one hand, some of them see him as the one who will implement the ideals of the French Revolution after the excesses of Robespierre. Others see him as the betrayer of the ideals.
Like Beethoven with his Third Symphony.
So you have this very divided ideas. The younger generation in Jena, they admire Napoleon. For them, he's almost the epitome of the genius who comes from nothing and uses his own kind of, creative genius.
He was kind of a rock star for them.
Yes. And it helps also that Napoleon was deeply interested in the arts and the sciences. So, for example, he sends his 200 scholars with his army to Egypt. That is something that the Jena set very much admires. Yes, he's this military person, but he also embraces the arts and the sciences.
And Napoleon also led the university functioning when the citizens asked for that.
In Jena?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So he protects the university in Jena when he's there. But also bear in mind that when the French come, we now think, oh, there's a, enemy army arriving in Jena. It's just terrible. It's going to destroy Jena, which it does. But at the same time, there are many Germans who want to be a republic. So they might be defeated by the French, but that might we become part of France, and that will mean we don't live in absolutism anymore. So they welcome the French, even if it means, their houses might be destroyed. So again, it divides the Germans. Some Germans don't want the French to come, others welcome the French.
Yeah, and one of the strangest things in your book is that when Napoleon came to Jena, Goethe was out of town because he also lived near Weimar, and Napoleon slept in the bed of Goethe.
Yeah, in the old castle in Jena, where Goethe spends many, many months every year in Jena, which is just 15 miles away from Weimar, where his main house is. And when he's in Jena, he stays in a few rooms in the old castle. And then at the Battle of Jena, when Napoleon is in town, he stays in Goethe's bedroom, and people can see him kind of pacing up and down through the window.
And only a few years later, Goethe really met Napoleon.
Yes, he meets him in 1808 in
And he
Erfurt.
Was impressed.
He was impressed. Napoleon talked to him about the sorrows of young Werther. And I think that Goethe also thought that he would bring order back to Germany.
And because he admired Goethe so much, Napoleon, after a few days, you know, having more than one conversation with Goethe, decided not to destroy the Principality of Sachsen-Weimar, which, you know, whose duchess was a sister of the Tsar, so was the enemy, but only because Goethe was so admired by him, and he had read all Goethe's novels and books, he kept Weimar alive. It's an incredible story.
No, and Napoleon travels with this big library. As he, you know, on his military campaigns, he has a library of books, and he has Goethe's books. He has some of the books from the Jena set. I think he might have had like some Humboldt books.
No, he hated Alexander von Humboldt.
He hated Humboldt, but that didn't mean that he wouldn't read
wouldn't
his
read
books.
It, no, no,
yeah.
No.
Because he saw Humboldt's book as a competition to his own publications on Egypt.
And we know that when he had talked to Goethe, which was at breakfast, and discussed his book, and then said, "Your Duke is a stupid young man, and I'm going to punish him." And Goethe then, you know, sort of tried to mediate, and successfully, that when Goethe then left, that he said to Talleyrand, "Voici un homme."
Yeah.
But your book ends with the destruction of Jena by the Napoleonic troops. It looks more or less like Mariupol nowadays. And in the end, also the group fell apart. They went to live in other places. Was this maybe a little bit symbolic? Did he also destroy maybe the brilliant young minds as well?
I think that the destruction, the kind of breaking apart, actually happens way before. And I think part of that is actually Caroline Schlegel, who is really the heart and mind of the Jena set.
Yeah,
and
it was in her house that all those people met.
Exactly. So but she's much more than just the muse, because we tend to describe women in the 18th century who are part of such a group as just the muse who creates the physical space. But she was.
Or is this nice woman who has this salon for all these men to be brilliant?
She's much more. She writes reviews under her husband's name. She is the editor of their literary magazine. She translates with her husband 16 Shakespeare plays. So when her world breaks, because her daughter dies and she really crumbles, that's also the moment when the group slowly breaks apart. So by the time Napoleon arrives in 1806, most of them have already left Jena. So you have Fichte, who leaves in 1799. You have Novalis, who dies in 1801. Friedrich Schlegel and Dorothea Veit leave in 1802. Caroline and August Wilhelm get divorced in 1803 and leave Jena. So by the time that Napoleon arrives, you only really have Hegel.
So Caroline wasn't able to hold the group together anymore.
No. So Napoleon met already a virtual ruin and made it a real ruin.
In a way, I think he was not. At that time, he was. I'm not sure how much he was aware of them. What is fascinating for me to see is how, when Madame de Stael publishes her book on Germany, which is all about these ideas that are kind of bubbling up in Jena.
He is furious on this
book. Napoleon is furious, and he pulps the first edition.
Because the book is too positive about Germany and German culture.
He can just not bear this idea that Madame de Stael writes a book which praises the Germans over the French. And she coins this phrase, "The Germans are a nation of writers and thinkers." He does not like that at all. But that's a bit later. So she publishes that in 1810 or 1811. So this is after the Battle of Jena. So I don't think he's very aware of what is happening there as he arrives with his army. Jena is just on his way to Berlin. And that's where the French and the Prussian army come together.
Yeah, Caroline was the woman that brought all those people together. Was she already also a kind of feminist before feminism really was there?
I think so. For me, she really sits at the center of this book. If I introduce her properly, I would introduce her with her four names: Caroline, Michaelis, Böhmer, Schlegel, Schelling.
That's her father and her three husbands.
Not counting that French soldier of 18 made her pregnant.
She was not married to him. So she's really a woman who refuses to be restricted by the role that society intends for women at that time. She's born in 1763. She's the daughter of a famous German scholar. She's brought up on a diet of literature, poetry, and politics.
I was fascinated to read that Benjamin Franklin visited the house of her parents.
And Goethe. I mean, she meets a lot of famous people around her father's table, basically. She speaks several languages fluently. She's very educated. She's fiercely independently minded. And then, she marries very early on when she's 20. She's a widow by the age of 24. She then hangs out with the German revolutionaries in Mainz, then gets imprisoned by the Prussians for being a sympathizer with the French Revolution. In prison, she discovers that she's pregnant after a one-night stand with an 18-year-old soldier, which is quite something at a time when it's been, you know, regarded as scandalous behavior, just being in a room with a man.
So in a way, there was no future anymore for her.
Absolutely not. She was called a revolutionary whore. She kind of zigzagged through Germany. And then August Wilhelm Schlegel comes, marries her, gives her a new name and a new beginning with that, and takes her to Jena. And there she becomes the heart and mind of the Jena set. They come to this very unusual arrangement of an open marriage. His younger brother is in love with her. She then takes Friedrich Schelling as her lover. He's 12 years younger. August Wilhelm doesn't really mind because he has his own lover. So there's a lot of, I mean, this book is about big ideas, but it's also a bit of a soap opera. There's lots of scandals happening.
And there was
there.
No jealousy in this marriage?
No, there was, because I think it was a marriage of convenience in a way. And they were really good friends. So when her daughter Augusta dies in 1800, age 15, and her world really crumbles and collapses, it's not her lover, Schelling, who comforts her. It's her best friend and husband, August Wilhelm Schlegel. Although she's already together with Schelling, it is August Wilhelm who is there for her and helps her. And their letters, even when they are separated, are very tender and very loving. Those letters are incredible to read because there's so much respect and tenderness and friendship between them.
If you look at this very special, as you call it, Jena set, is this the first time, let's say, in European cultural history in which men and women, not just as muse and, you know, servants and being adored, but are equals, are each other's inspirations?
I think it has happened. It has happened before. There are some very important women for men who work together, and only, you know, later on we kind of work out that that's what's happened. Because obviously when they publish, everything that is published under the name of the husbands and the men. So I don't think they're the first, but they are very outspoken, in particular Friedrich Schlegel, about his belief that men and women are equal. Others in the group, like Fichte, don't believe that at all, or Schiller. Schiller very much believes in the roles, the women are at home and compliant and beautiful and lovely, and the man is, you know, creates the kind of public persona. But Friedrich Schlegel writes about it. August Wilhelm Schlegel very clearly does not have a problem having a strong wife. So he must believe in this kind of, that women are strong and equal. I mean, Dorothea Veit, who is Friedrich Schlegel's lover, she also...
She's my favorite woman in the book.
Is she?
Yes.
Oh, no, mine is Caroline,
yeah,
definitely.
Of course, I know. but her, you know, her life in Berlin, and then, you know, go for the adventure, and, you know, also in her personal life, being Jewish, and then so, you know, out front, so...
But also,
she
gets divorced and risks not seeing her children ever again. She's absolutely fascinating. I think my problem with her later on is that she becomes quite bitchy and turns against Caroline, and it's a bit like why are you writing such horrible things about her? Which Carolina obviously didn't know at that time because it's in the letters, which Carolina didn't see.
They wrote tens of thousands of letters. It must not have been possible to read them all for you.
Well, I spent 5 years doing this book, so I've read quite a lot, I would say. For me, the letters are, first of all, there are thousands and thousands.
So it's a sort of a stream of consciousness, those letters.
But no, I don't think so. It is a window into their life. You know, these letters bring alive how the friends lived, gossiped, loved. It gives you an insight that is very different to reading their works, because the works, their public persona, but their letters, that's their private life. And because these are poets, the letters are beautifully written. Because for me, what's very important is to write a book that has almost a novelistic feel to the place. I want my readers to smell Jena, to see how the streets looked like. What did they eat? How did it smell? But I don't want to invent anything. So all of this comes from letters. And it's not just their letters. Don't forget, there are almost 900 students who write letters to their parents, to describing how their time in Jena is.
So and then all Goethe's letters, who, of course, you know, talked about them, about this younger generation, who he found fascinating, but also sometimes a bit, you know, wild. So that gives another perspective.
Yes.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
NPG en ik praten met Andrea Wolf, auteur van het boek Rebelse Genieën, onder meer over de filosoof Johann Gottlieb Fichte. You said that Fichte was not ready for what we now call women's rights, but he was the inventor of the ich, the self. Isn't that strange? Because later on feminism, I think, had to be thankful for the ich as a conception.
Yes, so he's the one who, I'm not quite sure, you know, I mean, the subtitle of the book is The Invention of the Self, but it's a bit like The Invention of Nature. He didn't invent the self, but he put the self at the center stage of his thinking.
And that is the similarity, of course, with what Alexander von Humboldt did, but discovering that all those different natural phenomena are an organic total, not just, let's say, the weather, being climate on Earth, but it is part of a cosmos. His famous book that he said, the Earth is just this one thing in this whole thing, in which he even said, so there may be life on different planets. So this whole idea of the concept of nature and the concept of ich, of self, are the two things which, you know, this generation brings.
Well, that's the two things that kind of defines a lot of our thinking today. But so if we look at Fichte and how he defined the self, what he did is he said, there are no God-given or absolute truth. The only certainty we have is that the world is experienced by the self. And he says all the source of all reality is the self. And he says the self posits its own being. So the self brings itself into existence. Now, that doesn't sound very exciting maybe for us, because we're so used to understanding the world through the prism of our self and our mind. But at that time, it was a radically new idea, because for centuries, philosophers and thinkers had said that the world is ruled by a divine hand. And Fichte said, no, it is us, you know, it's the ich that also creates our knowledge of the, what he calls the non-ich, the external world, which means it doesn't mean that the ich creates the external world, but it creates our knowledge of the external world. So the ich becomes free. So Fichte gives us the most thrilling of all powers, which is free will and self-determination. And that, I think, is the basis of the modern self today, in all its, you know, the good and the bad things.
So Fichte then also brings forward the idea that each person now has its own self and therefore identity and can develop that.
He basically puts the self into the center of everything. And behind this, I think, are two crucial questions. Who am I as an individual and who am I as a member of a society? How can I live a fulfilled life in which I follow my dreams, but also be a good member of society? And I think the pandemic is the best example for that. So on the one hand, you know, millions of us gave up our basic rights because we believed it was for the greater good. And then a few of us said their personal liberties are more important. And this tension between free will and selfishness, the, you know, great breathtaking possibilities of free will and the pitfalls of narcissistic kind of behavior, that's at the center of this book. This idea, how can we be free without centering too much around ourselves? And that's where Fichte is obviously very important, because he's been accused even during his lifetime of, you know, the fetishism of the self, but he never intended a kind of narcissistic celebration of the self. The Jena said, set this ich free with the intention of creating a better society at a time when most of Europe was still held in the, you know, iron fist of absolutism.
So Fichte might not be happy when he came into this world of 2022 and saw all those people obsessed with the self, also nowadays through the internet and social media.
Yeah, so what Fichte said is freedom always comes with its responsibility and our moral obligations. So freedom gives us the choice how we act, how we behave. It kind of elevates us over our base instinct. Freedom always comes with its twin moral obligations.
And that's what Schiller, of course, said about the French. That he said the French, they have this freedom, but they don't have this responsibility. Maybe because absolutism, like in Russia today, for instance, and in China, absolutism doesn't teach the people that moral responsibility.
Yes.
So liberalism implies that you have to be social.
And that's what I think, this is why this is a very important story, because right now, I think, so we think we are free to think, we are free to form our opinions, we are free to determine our lives. But if you look properly around us, this very core of our democratic societies is under threat, be it through Russia's cyber interference with democratic elections, be it fake news, or look at the US Supreme Court's decision to reverse Roe versus Wade. You know, women can't, well, in Poland and abortion rights. So women can't even decide about their bodies anymore. So I think it's important to look at when is the birth of our free self, and how much do we want to fight for this self-determined self at a time when we are manipulated by despots, by liars, and by right-wing populist movements.
It's maybe what happens now in the world, 200 years after this Jena set came up, maybe also might be the beginning of the end of this kind of liberalism.
Well, I very much hope that we will wake up in time to not give all of these rights away, you know, because we tend to always say, like, oh, we all, you know, we all circle around ourselves, we're all kind of obsessed with ourselves, which is true, because it's this balancing act. But the free self is something that's the building block of our Western society. So we don't really want to give that away. But we want to be aware of this balancing act, that we don't slip into, it's just about me and, you know, the me generation and the TikTok generation who's like hypnotized by their own images on their smartphones. Of course, that's the negative side of it. But the positive side of it is a free democratic society.
One of the things which, of course, is very, very striking in your book, both the Humboldt book and the Jena set book, is that through Goethe in particular, but also the Humboldt brothers, the Jena set was connected, let's say, to a European, even global community of cultural innovators, scientists, thinkers. As Jaap always said, they knew everybody, all of them. Now, which of those friendships and relationships, let's say outside Jena, were for you the most surprising in the sense of the most productive?
I don't know. I think for me, it's not so much one particular one. For me, it's always the group together. That's the reason why I love writing group biographies, because we tend to, you know, we put like Goethe on a pedestal or Schiller on a pedestal, but none of us works in a vacuum. You know, we always are in a big social context.
Yeah, in your book, you quote Novalis, the poet. He says, I produce best in dialogue.
Yeah, and I need people because they electrify me. And I think this working together was really important for them. And it because inspired them, and because they were scientists and poets and playwrights. So they approach different subjects from different angles. And that's what's so important. So you have, for example, someone like Alexander von Humboldt, who is in Jena doing experiments on animal electricity. And then you have someone not like Novalis, who is also a mining inspector, but he writes poetry, but he's using his work by going deep into the bowels of the earth to write about darkness and death. So they're bringing together these different aspects, which they learn from, you know, they learn from each other. So it's the working together, it's the being of together of different minds. That's
so also
important.
being in a cafe and drinking together might produce new poems the next day.
And they very much celebrate this eating, drinking together. There are wonderful quotes from their letters where they describe how they sit together and they just come up with rhymes and poems and they agree to never agree. So these discussions are noisy and loud and they're fighting. So this is not like nodding to each other saying like, yes, you're right. Yes, you're right. It's about disagreement also.
Goethe famously said that talking to his 20 years younger friend, Alexander von Humboldt, for an hour gives you stuff to chew on for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think he also said something like spending 1 hour with him is like reading books for 8 years or something like that. So it is, I mean, especially, I mean, this is how I fell into this book, through this friendship between Alexander von Humboldt and Goethe. And it's that's a great example. So you have Alexander von Humboldt, the scientist, Goethe, the poet and scientist, who says, Humboldt has woken my scientific interest from hibernation. And then you see Goethe beginning to put scientific ideas into his poetic works. Like Faust, for example, has a lot of the kind of latest.
Faust is a scientist. It's himself.
Faust is like Alexander von Humboldt. As when you see how Goethe describes Faust, and he writes, I mean, he pulls out his manuscript after Humboldt left, almost as if Humboldt's personality inspired him, because Faust has this kind of relentless, kind of restless searching for knowledge, how the world is kind of put together.
Faust wants to conquer the world and even sells his soul to the devil in order to do that. What did Humboldt do? He spent his huge inheritance, he was one of the richest young guys in Europe, to conquer the world.
To understand the world.
Of course, yes, but to conquer it is as a concept.
With knowledge, to gain all the knowledge of the world. And that's exactly what Humboldt does, obviously, when he went to South America. And Alexander von Humboldt said that the time in Jena, and that Goethe had given him new organs to see the world. So he arrives in Jena as a, you know, as a empiricist, as a scientist who believes in calculating and measuring and instruments, and he continues to believe that, but he also leaves and believes that imagination is as important. And I think for me that is a very important thing about the Jena set. These are scientists and poets who put imagination at the center of their thinking, which doesn't mean that they turn against reason, which I think we tend to think about the Romantics. Oh, it's just about emotion and imagination, but it's not. And for me, that is something that's very, very important in today's climate change debates, for example. Schelling talks about the unity between humankind and nature. And I think we sometimes forget that we are part of nature, not just physically, but also emotionally and psychologically. And today, in climate change debates, we talk about, you know, scientists bombard us with statistics and numbers. No one really talks about the awe for nature, our emotional connection to nature.
And so that, the debate is too technocratic
at the moment. I think it's too technocratic. And again, just like the Romantics, I'm not saying that's not important. I think
we need that scientific analysis.
We need that, the projections. That's incredibly important. But sometimes we also need artists and poets and writers to convey the meaning of these numbers and projections. Because there's, for me, one great example. There was a few years ago, David Attenborough's Blue Planet had one episode where an albatross fed its chick with plastic. And it was such a shocking image that after that, we had made some legal changes and plastic bags were not allowed to be just given to you in a supermarket. You have to pay for them, which has obviously reduced the use of plastic bags. Now, we all knew before how bad plastic is, but it was the visual, the film that made it so shocking. And I think in that respect, we need different avenues to talk about the implications of the climate crisis, not just numbers and figures. And that is something where the early Romantics, I think, are very, very important, just to learn a little bit of a lesson, how you can use arts and science together.
There is another legacy from what you talk about, and that is this idea of the ich as a unique identity is, of course, the basis of Wilhelm von Humboldt's Bildungsideal. He said, the role of education is not to make farmers' children farmers, but to make children citizens.
Very important, yeah.
And that is the basis, of course, of every educational and knowledge, you know, revolution, innovation and policy since 1810.
And it's something that Wilhelm von Humboldt, I think, got from his time with the Jena set, the importance of the mind. And then he takes that when he's the Prussian education minister and he founds the first University of Berlin, which then becomes a research university. So it's not just that professors tell students what to do and how to learn, but students learn how to learn. And that becomes a role model for many, many, many universities after that.
It is what Osterhammel says in his book, that there are two great legacies of the German culture of that period, of the early 19th century, and he says that's classical music and the university, and as a universal concept which is everywhere in the world.
And this idea of this university is based on the idea of the self, exactly, from Jena.
And of course, from that idea of this unique aspect of the self, that of course became infused with the French Revolution, with the rights of man and the rights of the citizen. And that is, of course, what we now call human rights.
The basis of human rights is the individual, of course. So that comes from there. But now the interesting thing about this is also to kind of also look at the negative sides of this, is that especially in human rights, which has been so focused on individual rights, what about the rights of indigenous people as a group, for example? So it's a very Western concept, the ich, the self, the individual. And it stands in contrast to how other societies function.
Nowadays, you have in some countries like the Netherlands, a party for the animals. People thought that was crazy stuff. What's that, a party for the animals? But in the thinking of Fichte, you might say, when you destroy nature, you destroy the ich. So animal rights and the rights of nature are also human rights.
There's a whole movement, you know, the non-human rights for nature. So what rights does nature have? And I think there's Schelling's idea and Alexander von Humboldt's idea that nature is this kind of interconnected whole, that it's a living organism, that nature, that our self and nature is effectively identical, which means if we go into nature, it's always self-discovery. We are part of nature. If we destroy nature, we also destroy ourselves. So if you look at selfishness, in quotations, historically correct, we also ought to protect our planet, because in order to look after ourselves, we also need to protect the planet, because we are part of this.
Even tussendoor, PG, we moeten het er toch ook in deze aflevering even over hebben. Zouden Goethe, de broers van Humboldt, de broertjes Schlegel en al die anderen in Jena ook al bamboe gedragen hebben?
Nou, daar zeg je wat. Goethe was ongelooflijk gefascineerd door China en de Chinese cultuur. Panda's, daar eten die bamboe. En Alexander van Humboldt, die droomde ervan om een keer de Himalaya te bezoeken en dus ook daar in Tibet en bij China te komen. Om
dus
dat
hij
te
zou heel blij zijn geweest met Bamigo, die kleding maken van bamboe.
En zeker in die tijd waren die Jena studenten altijd in voor de nieuwste mode en de nieuwste spulletjes.
Ja, ze droegen ook jassen in allerlei kleuren.
Geel.
En wat je ook droeg, je kon er natuurlijk altijd, als ze in die tijd er al geweest waren, die boxershorts van Bamigo onderdragen. En misschien als je 's nachts nog een beetje aan het filosoferen was, zo'n joggingbroek van Bamigo.
Zeker in die tijd dat je een periode had dat het in Europa heel erg koud was.
Of in het café een overhemd van Bamigo, want dat is een van de nieuwe producten die ze daar maken. En het had ook nog heel erg aangesproken bij die mensen die de gedachte hadden, alles hangt met alles samen en de natuur moet je koesteren. Je moet dus ook denken aan duurzaamheid, al bestond dat woord toen nog niet. Maar daar is Bamigo ook heel goed in.
Nou, dat is helemaal in de sfeer van Alexander von Humboldt en de bescherming van de tropische regenwouden en de Andes waar hij rondtrok.
En ja, in die tijd, ook die filosofen, die zaten vaak zonder geld. Dus die waren ook heel blij geweest als ze 25% korting hadden kunnen krijgen. Wat speciaal voor jou als luisteraar van Betrouwbare Bronnen nu aan de orde is. Dus let even op. Met de code BRON25, dus gewoon aan elkaar geschreven, BRON25, kun je op de website van Bamigo, bamigo.com, nu korting krijgen op je eerste bestelling. BRON25.
We praten verder met Andrea Wolf over al die interessante denkers in die korte periode, eind 18e eeuw, allemaal bijeen in Jena.
What is so fascinating here, if you look at the Jena set, but also at the founding fathers, you know, just a little bit earlier, but also in their time in the US, is that they both come up with this concept that philosophy is not a sort of abstract thing for theoretical types who write very thick books, you know, Hegel, Kant, Fichte. No, it is very political. It is essential for social relations and political development.
And if you look at America after the American Revolution and France after the French Revolution, what people could do is they could watch how a state was evolving out of the idea of a state, which is, if you think about this, like it was must have been the most thrilling thing for philosophers to see that, because you could see how these ideas become reality, not perfect realities, but at least the attempt of a reality.
So philosophy is real.
I think philosophy is real and philosophy is very powerful, 100%.
Now, there are many, many wonderful moments in the book. Jaap was already fascinated by Goethe's bed filled by Napoleon, which of course was this, another proof, Jaap, for what your eternal discovery in our podcast, they all knew each other. But for instance, Goethe was a Dutchman. He loved to skate. Tell us about that.
Well, Goethe loved to be outside, no matter what the weather is. So he goes on vigorous walks, but he loved skating. So there are lots of descriptions from students who study in Jena and who write home to their parents, describing how they saw the great Goethe skating on the Saale River with his kind of bulging belly, but very elegant and fast, apparently.
Was he their godfather?
I think he was the godfather of the younger generation. And
did he recognize himself in his wild Werther years?
Because he had really turned against this time of in his life, so he was not trying to turn back to the Sturm und Drang at all, but By the time the younger generation arrived in the mid-1790s, Goethe hadn't produced anything remarkable for years. He felt very depressed about the war with France. He had turned to the sciences to find some kind of comfort.
He had kind of a writer's block.
Exactly. So his creativity had kind of really run out. And the younger generation, in particular also Schiller, but also the younger generation, gave him a kind of new lease of creativity in life in a way. So he was inspired and rejuvenated by their new and radical ideas.
So he took the skates in winter to get more energy from those young people.
I'm not quite sure if the skating had to do with that. It's more an intellectual skating with them, I think, than the real skating.
He also went from Weimar to Jena on a horse. He didn't like couches.
Yeah, he just loved being outside. So, and he always said that he needed a vigorous walk after a big meal, for example. So he kind of knew that exercise is important, and he would always ride between Jena and Weimar. And, I mean, this is like a 3-hour ride, but they do it all the time. It's just like as if we would go, you know, just hop in the car and go somewhere. So although it's 15 miles, which is, you know, at that time a 3-hour ride, they very much see Weimar and Jena as kind of neighboring towns.
If you would visit Jena today, would you still recognize the little 18th century university town?
Yes and no. So, I mean, Jena was heavily bombed in the Second World War. So there's not much left. What you can still see is the market, the open market with the houses around it and the old town hall. So that would be a Jena you can recognize.
And if we walk there, like you did, you see also the nameplates of all those fascinating people.
Yes, you do. But I would say that Jena has not made the most out of its history. Weimar is much, much better. Weimar has really has rebuilt many houses, and Goethe's house, Schiller's house, there is pretty spectacular.
Nietzsche's house.
And Jena is, I think for a long time, Jena sees its legacy more in Zeiss, the lens maker, so it's and a scientific university. And they're almost embarrassed by the Romantics, I have the feeling. So I'm hoping that they realize that it works together, the arts and the sciences. They could make a bit more of it.
But maybe also this free spirit in thinking, in acting, in being, you know, together. Something which the communist regime did not want to highlight too much.
Probably, yes. Exactly. Well, the focus on science was probably better than that, yeah.
Now, after the destruction of Jena by Napoleon, the destruction of Napoleon by Europe, and his exile, Romanticism became the dominant rebellious spirit of the young in Europe. But the Sturm und Drang of the young Goethe years and the Jena set, they evolved, and Romanticism became, after, let's say, 1815, anti-Enlightenment, reactionary, sentimental, nationalistic. This was not what the Jena set had been striving for.
Not originally, no. But interestingly enough, if you have a bunch of rebellious thinkers, they become very often more reactionary.
Like Napoleon himself.
Yeah, or take the 1968 student revolution. You know, quite a lot of those rebellious students became much more conservative when they became older. What's interesting to see for me, for example, is when you look at Fichte, who liberated the self, but then after Napoleon, he gives a series of lectures, which is called the Addresses to the German Nation, in which he talks about really the self of a nation. Because Napoleon, you know, in his eyes, had destroyed so much. So he is focusing on the same language. You know, the different German nations are speaking the same language, and that's why it should be a nation, which was then later used by the Nazis. So there is a shift in the second generation of Romantics towards nationalism, towards looking back at Germans, folklore and fables and finding this, you know, the Germanness. And that's not what the first generation was looking at. And quite the opposite. They were very, very international in their outlook. So Friedrich Schlegel, for example, he founded a magazine called Europe, in which he wanted to bring all these different ideas from Europe together. But Friedrich Schlegel himself then becomes really reactionary later. He works for Metternich. He becomes Catholic. He very much turns against Napoleon. So quite a few of them become quite reactionary.
Can I try something out? In 1815, there was some, you know, in that year, somebody was born who was brilliant, who was reactionary, was a great literary mind, was very European-oriented and nationalistic. Otto von Bismarck. Is he the real legacy of the Jena set and the Romantics in Germany?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. Probably, I would say no. I would say no. No, no. I'm saying no.
What will be your next book?
I don't know. Give me a moment.
Maybe on Bismarck.
No, definitely not. I don't know. I have, you know, I spent 5 years writing this, and I have a couple of ideas, but I've not really had time to think about a new book.
Wilhelm von Humboldt?
No.
No, he's
no, I've spent a lot of time with the Humboldts now. I think it's time to move on.
To move on.
Yes, it's a bit like, you know, Alexander von Humboldt is, I've spent more time with Alexander von Humboldt than with my family. So I think it's time to move away from the Humboldts.
Will it still be a book on German cultural philosophical history, or will you go somewhere else?
I don't know. I mean, I've done books before. I've done books about the American founding fathers, for example. So I don't know. I'm looking around with a very, very, very open mind.
Maybe one day you'll write about the Netherlands?
Maybe. I don't know. It's also, but one big problem is language, you know, because I'm so focused on letters and diaries, and you need to be able to read them, and you can't ask a researcher to read them for you because you don't know what you're looking for. So for example, when in this book, there are little moments like a student describing to his parents how he almost got the content of a chamber pot on his head as he was walking through the streets in the night. You know, you can't ask a researcher to, you know, look out for the chamber pot that's going to be flung out of the window. So I need to read these letters myself. And as I can't read Dutch, that would be problematic.
We're coming to the end of our conversation. I think we can recommend your book to all of our listeners.
Thank you.
When I read it, it was like a movie, sometimes even like a soap opera.
It could be a Netflix series.
Ha, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Dorothea Veit could be a Netflix lady, no doubt.
In other words, the book will enrich you when you read it. May we thank you very much, Andrea, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
PG, dat was een zeer interessant gesprek met Andrea Wolf.
Ja, het mooie natuurlijk is dat iemand met zo'n oeuvre in zo'n gesprek het niet alleen maar over het meest recente boek gaat, maar dat je als het ware de hele context ook van dat oeuvre ziet. En ook hoe zij ook vertelt dat in het onderzoeken, research, rondkijken zelfs, voor het boek van Alexander von Humboldt, ze dus al die naambordjes in dat kleine stadje tegenkwam en dus ontdekte, Humboldt zat in een generatiecontext die hem in hoge mate, net als zijn broer Wilhelm, dus heeft gevormd. En dat was als het ware weer de reden om in die brieven en in die mensen en hun bestaan te duiken.
En al die mensen die kwamen ook overal vandaan toen ze zich vestigden in Jena, en ze vertrokken ook weer naar allerlei plekken op de wereld. Maar wat mij opviel, ik kijk altijd in een boek, komt Nederland erin voor? Nou, het kwam er één keertje in voor. Amsterdam wordt genoemd, maar dan eigenlijk op een wat negatieve manier. Namelijk vertrekken uit Amsterdam in een beetje lousy koets, om dan uiteindelijk in dat prachtige Jena te eindigen.
En toch, Jaap, is er tussen die Jena-groep en dat stadje en de geschiedenis van ons land een hele bijzondere band. En dat is natuurlijk met die geleerde die ook premier werd uit de kleine Lutherse Duitse minderheid in Nederland.
Johan Rudolf Thorbecke, die geboren is vlak voordat die hele Jena-set ontstond. Dus op de een of andere manier moet hij ook wel kennis hebben genomen, denk ik, van de productiviteit en hun creativiteit in hun geschriften.
Nou, hij is in zekere zin ingetrouwd in de Jena-set. Want hij kwam als jonge jongen, en dan heb je het over 1819, 1820, in Duitsland als student. En ging naar universiteiten als die van Göttingen en natuurlijk naar wat toen, dankzij Wilhelm van Humboldt, de universiteit in Duitsland was geworden, die van Berlijn, door Humboldt bedacht en opgericht.
En waar ook mensen doseerden die nog in Jena hadden gewerkt of gestudeerd.
In het bijzonder de grote inspirator van Thorbecke, de jonge Thorbecke, de dichter en filosoof en vertaler en de man met een enorm oeuvre, meneer Ludwig Tieck. En Ludwig Tieck had in Jena gezeten en was dus alle avonden thuis bij Caroline Schlegel, was bevriend met Novalis, ontmoette er Schelling, Goethe, Schiller. En hij werd ook zelf eigenlijk beschouwd als een soort tweede Goethe in zijn tijd. Waarom? Hij was een enorm belangrijke vertaler van de Europese letterkunde in het Duits. Don Quixote van Cervantes en bijvoorbeeld het hele werk van Shakespeare is het werk geweest van Tieck.
En dit ontleen jij, PG, aan dat prachtige boek van Remy Aerts, Thorbecke wil het. Want daar staat dit allemaal in beschreven, deze link.
En op een bepaald moment gaat dus de jonge Thorbecke dan in Dresden zeer bevriend raken met het gezin Solger. En dat was een weduwe, maar nog heel jong. En haar dochter, met wie hij in het bijzonder bevriend raakte. Er gingen zelfs sterke verhalen ook uit de brieven dat die weduwe, hoewel wat ouder dan Thorbecke, misschien wel met hem wilde trouwen. En zij was de weduwe van een van de belangrijke jonge filosofen uit die Jena-kring. Uiteindelijk is Thorbecke getrouwd met die dochter. En zo is er dus een hele bijzondere persoonlijke, maar dus ook wetenschappelijke en literaire band tussen toch wel een van de bijzonderste mensen in onze geschiedenis en zeker van de 19e eeuw en dus die generatie van daarvoor in Jena.
Opnieuw een bewijs, eigenlijk ook van de filosofie van Alexander van Humboldt. Alles hangt met alles samen. En ook al een beetje, waar wij het vaker over hebben, iedereen, ook toen al in de elite, kende iedereen.
Men kwam elkaar toch altijd weer tegen, dankzij de inspiratie van kunst, literatuur, filosofie en wetenschap. Je kunt het dan ook niet genoeg koesteren allemaal.
Dat prachtige boek van Andrea Wolf, Rebelse Genieën, heet het boek in het Nederlands. Het is uitgegeven door Atlas Contact. En ik wil toch even op een voetstuk plaatsen de vertalers, want het is ook heel mooi vertaald. Fanny Steenhuis, Nanny de Nijs, Bik Plasman en Meike van Leersum hebben het vertaald. Het zijn 426 pagina's en daarnaast ook nog eens 160 pagina's noten. Zodat je echt de historicus kunt herkennen. Je kunt als je wil ook nog zelfs naar Jena gaan, zoals Andrea Wolf ooit begonnen is. En de basis van dit boek daar terugvinden in alle naamplaten op de huizen waar deze inmiddels voor de lezer bekende mensen ook allemaal gewoond hebben.
Jaap, en daarom hebben wij een verrassing voor onze vrienden van de show. Alweer.
Ja, je kunt meedingen naar één van de twee exemplaren die uitgeverij Atlas Contact beschikbaar stelt van het prachtige boek. Ben je vriend van de show, dan krijg je hierover bericht hoe dat gaat. Via de mail en ook op vriendvandeshow.nl/bb kun je dat lezen. Twee boeken deze keer. Dus als je het echt heel graag wil, stuur dan een mailtje volgens de methode die op Vriend van de Show wordt uitgelegd.
Lees Magnificent Rebels, Rebelse Genieën van Andrea Wolf.
Tot volgende keer.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Jansen in samenwerking met dag-en-nacht.nl.